Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Alpharetta, Georgia, it's time for Alpharetta Business Radio, spotlighting the area's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Okay, everybody, it's your host, Chris Deekle, this morning in Alpharetta Business Radio. I have a prominent franchise attorney with me, Michael Rosenthal. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning. Welcome.
He is with Wagner, Johnson, and Rosenthal, and they specialize in the specialty area of law of franchise law. And Atlanta is a huge franchise center, isn't it, Michael?
It is. We've got a lot of very large franchise companies that are based here, and of course, being a big city, we have a tremendous number of franchisees as well.
So it's that's interesting. Who is the biggest franchiser group here in Atlanta?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. You've got a lot of biggies, though. You've got Chick-fil-A, Waffle House, you have Arby's, Wendy's, so a lot of big
really big companies headquartered here. So I think I read a statistic, I think it was in the Southeast Franchise Forum, where there was something like 159 franchisers in Atlanta.
That wouldn't shock me, and there are a lot of startup franchise systems here as well that people may not be aware of. You know, I work with a few of them, and they may only have a half a dozen units or something like that as they're getting started and kind of getting their feet underneath them.
Wow. So, franchise law is really, people really don't know what a franchise is in terms of why the law considers it a franchise. And I know from my experience, beating around in network groups and talking to people in my business, that a lot, I've talked to several people who said, well, I don't want to have anything to do with a franchise. I want to license this. So I see your eyebrows going up. So, there's a story here, I'm sure.
A common term that you hear amongst franchise lawyers is the accidental franchisee. And the typical story is something like, Chris, you've got a great barbecue restaurant. Everybody says you have the best barbecue in Alpharetta, and you're successful with it. So you open another one in Cumming and then one in Roswell. And pretty soon you decide that you might want to open another one, but not you're not going to run it. So you're going to get your brother-in-law to do it. And he's kind enough to put up the money, and you authorize him to use your name and your recipes, and you tell him how to run the kitchen and hire employees. But you say it's not a franchise, it's a license. And you'd be wrong, because a franchise is a term defined by federal law under the Federal Trade Commission's franchise rule. And whether you want it to be a franchise or not, if you meet certain conditions, you're a franchise. So that's why we call it an accident, but it's often people trying to avoid the cost and the legal requirements, and they put themselves in a very bad position, because when your brother-in-law divorces your sister and decides he doesn't want to be in the barbecue business anymore, you may wind up in a lawsuit.
What are the triggers that make you a franchise?
Well, franchising by federal law is a sort of a three-legged stool. So the first leg is that I license you to use my trademark, a registered trademark, or a mark that I've applied for typically. The second is that I exercise significant control over the manner in which you operate your business, or I provide you with significant assistance, either one of those. And the third is very simple. You pay me money. So, and in theory, even a dollar will do it. So that's federal law. It gets kind of complicated because a number of states have franchise laws as well, and their definitions can be a little bit broader than that, some of the states, and we have to look at it state by state. But in the Southeast, for the most part, the states don't regulate franchising directly, so we don't have to deal with anything other than federal law.
I understand California and New York are infamous for their laws.
They're very broad, and they can be pretty aggressive in enforcing them. Oddly, one of the states that's most aggressive is Maryland.
Maryland?
Yep. I liken it to Maryland, with all due respect to the regulators there, is sort of like a speed trap for franchisors. So you have to be very, very careful about how you drive through that state if you're a franchisor.
So if I have a business, and what I'm thinking of in particular was a carpet cleaning company that had a really good process, had really well-trained people, but wanted to expand out of it. But I said, you know, you need to talk to a franchise lawyer if you're going to do this. I don't want to have anything to do with franchises. I can license this. I talked to some attorney, you know, who was on the internet who said he can do it for $5,000 and I can make it a license and I'll never have to fool with this stuff.
All I can say is be careful. You know, as I said, it's a three-legged stool. Franchising is three-legged stool. So what we do, if somebody like that were to approach me, is I say, what can we do to take one of the legs out from the stool? The easiest one to take out is the upfront payment of the money. So you could license something, and if there's no required payment upfront or during the first 6 months, typically, we can keep you from being a franchise. The problem is most people don't want to let others use their business for free, so it doesn't work. Another way to do it would be to let you use my process but not let you use my trademark. So maybe you tell me how to do the carpet cleaning and hire people, but I don't use your name, and I call it Mike's Carpet Cleaning instead. Again, usually people want to buy into they see value in the trademark. So, you know, in most circumstances, they can call it whatever they want, but it's the old flies like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. It's a duck.
It's a duck. And you know, what are the, you know, I mean, I've heard all kinds of numbers for what it costs to do the legal work to launch a franchise. You know, is there any guideline that, you know, so there's some, you know, measure of how big is big?
Fair question. Typically, what I tell people is that we're looking to start something in Georgia because, again, if we go to one of the regulated states, and typically they happen to be blue states if you want to get political, but in Georgia where we don't have state requirements, we're looking at somewhere between typically $10,000 and $20,000 to do the legal work. And it frankly depends upon how cooperative the client is with me. There's a lot of information that we have to exchange. Oftentimes, people that are successful in business are very busy running their business, and they don't focus on responding to inquiries that we make, or frequently, as we start the process, they're redesigning things as we go, and that drives the cost up. But that would be a typical range, and frankly, while that's the legal cost, I often tell people if you're going to start a franchise, you've got to recognize there are a lot of other costs besides legal, and that legal is really a minority of the cost.
And what are those other costs?
Typically, you've got to market the franchise to get it out there. So people have this image in their mind, you know, we're back to your carpet cleaning fellow or your barbecue joint, that what I have is so wonderful that someone else is going to come along and want to buy it, or a bunch of people are going to come along and want to buy it. And I'm not going to have to market it as a business. And generally what I hear from my clients is that's just not true. So you may have the barbecue joint, and because your food is so good, people keep coming up to you and saying, Chris, I love this place. You know, if you franchise it, I'd love to buy one. And if 50 or 100 people say that to you, when you start telling them how much it's going to cost to actually open a restaurant, you know, that you're kind of getting to the bottom of the funnel. And so typically you have to get out there and market it. And the way that you do that, like most things nowadays, is online. You know, there are websites that advertise franchises. You appear at franchise shows and expos, which are big convention facilities. So you've got the cost of paying for the booth and the travel and sometimes in periodicals like Franchise Times.
No, and also the broker network. I mean, you have to spend the money to acquaint the brokers with your franchise, and I mean, that's not an insignificant sum either.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And while it's not an upfront cost, certainly if I sell a franchise through a broker, the broker is going to fairly want to be paid a commission.
And you know, those are fairly substantial commissions. So, you know, there are some big costs involved, and they're not really on the legal side. They're really on the operations and the marketing side.
That's right. And, you know, one other cost that I think people tend to overlook is simply the cost of organizing sort of the back office side of their business. So, again, you've got these three barbecue joints, and you're going to go franchise it, and you're going to have to write an operations manual if you don't already have one. You may or may not be skilled at that. You may have the world's best barbecue, but you may not know how to write a 200 or 300 or 500-page manual. So you may have to pay somebody to help you do that. Oftentimes, there's software that's involved in running a business. If you get to a certain size, you may have business management software, just like any big company, and you want to give your franchisees, if you can, an operational dashboard that they can work from. So you're going to have to pay somebody to write or rewrite or, tweak some software that they already have.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's software, there's operations manuals, there are support for people that have the franchise, have a store, barbecue joint, whatever it is, or running a carpet machine, that you have to go out and help troubleshoot, and because you're not successful unless they are.
That's right. And I tell clients that if you're franchising your business, and again, using our barbecue mm-hmm. guy as an example, you're going to go from being a restaurateur to a franchisor, and it's a completely different business. There's some relationship, obviously, between the two businesses, but you're now in the business of selling franchises and supporting your franchisees, and the restaurant side of the business is really ancillary to that. Sure, you have to have great barbecue, and you have to continue to develop your menu. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at some of the really huge restaurant systems, they're always out there redeveloping products that they can provide in order to stay ahead of things and to keep from becoming stale. But now it's about servicing your franchisees.
Yeah. And this is advice and insight that normally people don't think a lawyer can bring to the table, but you're giving great advice here. I mean, stuff that people pay good money for.
You know, it's funny, but there's if you look at our letterhead, and I think this is true for most lawyers, it says attorneys and counselors at law. So since I don't do domestic relations or family law practice, I guess the counseling is on the business side. And look, there are still people out there that are professional franchise consultants that we work with and I see our clients work with who really do understand the business side more. And they can, I can give you the 30,000-foot view. They're going to get down into the weeds and really get into the nitty-gritty of how you set these things up, again, not from a legal standpoint, but a practical one.
An operational standpoint. Yeah. Here are the things you've got to have to open your doors and make this thing work and not have it get out of control.
That's right. Now, I will say this. I have a few clients that are small franchise systems, and I will kind of liken them to mom and pops. And sometimes they are a husband and wife team. Mm-hmm. They have a business, and they've franchised it, and they don't have the goal of growing it quickly. So they start out, they franchise it. They may actually have what I call the warm market, meaning they may have a brother-in-law or a friend or someone that wants to buy one, and they may sell one or two the first year, one or two the second year. And if they keep their growth under control, sometimes they can manage that process without having to go out and spend a lot of money. At some point, if you grow to a certain size, you're going to need more staff.
Become a businessman and not a lawn care or carpet cleaner or something else.
Most definitely. Yeah. And like any business, the hard part oftentimes is knowing when to hire that person to help you and hiring the right person.
And hiring the right person, exactly. And most people that kind of grow up in one of these businesses typically kind of got into it maybe out of high school and, you know, or have always loved it. But they really haven't had a broad business background. I mean, sometimes obviously they do, but, you know, having people that can help them with that or know that they need help in that so they don't make mistakes is really pretty critical.
It is, and it's hard. I think back when I grew up, my dad had a small restaurant on the north side of Chicago, and as I understand it, he started that. He was fought in the Korean War and came back, got married, had a kid, me, and he opened this little restaurant, and I think he was pretty successful with it, but he focused on some of the basics. You know, from talking with him, he kept the restaurant immaculately clean. Mm-hmm. Back then, everybody paid cash. No one was allowed to touch the cash register except Dad or my grandmother. And, you know, there's just some basics that go with running a business, but he didn't have the other kinds of training to look at things like numbers and marketing. You know, he was successful, I suppose, because he was well-located, was nice to people, and served good food.
Well, it's amazing how the basics are really the key to success in most businesses.
I think that's true. I also think, you know, that was 1955 when he started that business, and it's a different world now. I mean, life is, it is more complicated. You have to stick to the basics, but I think there's perhaps more organization and thought that go into the basics.
Yeah, I mean, there are supplier issues. I mean, you didn't know the supplier. You're probably getting it from a some corporate group now. You've got of course all the wage and law and wage law and everything associated with that, taxation, IRS, Department of Labor. All of a sudden you've got all these people involved that in the old days were pretty simple, but now it's really complicated.
Definitely much more complicated. From what he tells me, the biggest complication he had back then is that it's certain purveyors associated with certain ethnic groups might have leaned on him to pay higher prices threatened to break the windows of the restaurant if he didn't. So
that didn't happen. That was in the movies. In Chicago, I've heard some stories too. We did a lot of business up in Chicago. And I've certainly heard my share of them. This is from the franchisors or the Zors perspective in the vernacular of the group. What about from somebody that wants to buy a franchise? Do you work with them?
Very frequently, and work with them in different ways. Obviously, very often, probably once a week, I talk with someone that's interested in buying a franchise. They tend to fall into two categories. Prospects who have come to me through a franchise broker, sometimes they call themselves consultants, essentially, and not meaning to demean them because I think they provide a great service, they are brokers. And then the other group would be people that find me randomly who, through some means, have found a franchise they're interested in purchasing. And they really often are two very distinct groups because the people that come and have been working with a broker tend to have been exposed to a number of possible franchises they want to buy. Oftentimes, they've given it more thought, and they're more analytical, and they're looking at the business issues. The people that come to me otherwise, sometimes they show those traits, and they've really been analytical, and sometimes they've just fallen in love with the concept that somebody has shown them, which isn't a terrible thing, but... I think if you talk to a professional, and by that I mean a broker, they tell you that just because you love golf doesn't mean you need to own a golf store franchise. Or because you love ice cream means you should own an ice cream franchise. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it makes money or that it's the right fit for your skill set, because we all come to business with an existing set of skills. And yes, it's the franchisor's job to train you as a franchisee, but there's some things that are harder to train people in than others.
Some people are good direction takers. They will follow the manual, so to speak. And there are other people that are not. They're going to do it their way. It doesn't matter what.
Well, and one of the things that a solid franchise system will try to determine is whether you are the sort of person who can take direction well. And so I'm going to use my dad, again, as an example. My father, the story is that the year I was born, 1957, a gentleman came into my father's restaurant and introduced himself, and my dad was 24, and he said, "I've heard really good things about you, Mr. Rosenthal, and you're a good young operator, and I've got this concept I'm bringing into the area. And if you're interested in looking at it, you can buy as many of these restaurants as you want for $5,000. You'll pay a 4% royalty, and you'll buy your food from my purveyor." And that gentleman was Ray Kroc. So for those who don't know, Ray Kroc was the founder of McDonald's. And my father listened to him briefly, apparently, and said, "Thanks a lot. The door's over there." So, well, and that's the reason I'm working today, I suppose. But, I think that... When you are dealing with a concept like that, it's hard to know. Obviously, you know, in 1957.
That was really pioneering days for franchises.
It really was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was completely off the radar until about, you know, the mid-60s.
I think that's right. And I can remember when the first McDonald's opened, actually in the area I grew up in. And the general impression we had is it was sort of a discount, low quality. Yeah. Obviously, they made a boat pile of money.
Consistency counted.
Oh, absolutely. And price was an attractive feature for people. They were, you know.
Speed, cost, and repeatability.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, interestingly enough, I met a guy coming off of his private plane down in Fort Lauderdale and, you know, had enough junk jewelry hanging off of him and, you know, fascinating ladies, let us say.
Okay.
That I said, I actually had my partner with me, who was an older gentleman, had gone to University of Florida, and I said, you have any idea who the heck that is? I mean, he's getting in this Bugatti, and, this thing is, this guy's got some serious money here. And he said, yeah, I know him. He played football with me at the University of Florida, and this guy named Ray Kroc came along and said, I'm looking for somebody to help me sell this stuff down in Florida. Is anybody interested? And he was an old jock, didn't have anything else to do. And he said, yeah, I'll do it.
Well, timing and location can be important.
So, I mean, he said, well, here, you own Florida if you sell this thing.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it's great stories that come out of the old franchise industry. But I've got a friend of mine. Let me change subjects here just a little bit. He's a very meticulous kind of guy. I mean, he's suspicious of everything. And one of his comments is, well, I'd never buy a franchise. It's just a scam. What do you say to that?
You know, first of all, franchising isn't for everyone. As you just said, if they don't take instruction well, like my dad, who not only threw Mr. Kroc out of the restaurant, but doesn't take instruction well, and he'd tell you that the worst experience of my father's life apparently was being in the Army, not because he was being shot at, but because he was being told what to do. But if you can take instruction well and you look at this as a business and you evaluate whether you think you can operate the business, you create a pro forma, it's like any other business opportunity. It's not a scam. Now, if it were a scam, there wouldn't be thousands and thousands and thousands of successful franchisees all over the country. The question is a particular franchise that's being offered to you going to be something that's going to be successful? And it's like any other business. You have to look at it and see whether it has the basics. Again, you shouldn't buy something because you love the concept. And I give an example of something that I don't know if they're still in business or not, but in the early part of the last decade, there was this concept that you could sell stuff on this internet site called eBay. And as a result, a number of different franchisors popped up across the country. And the idea was you'll have a retail store. People like me who are too lazy or inept on the internet to sell their own stuff online could come into the store and essentially consign the goods to you as a retailer, and you'd sell it for them. And people loved the idea, and literally hundreds, probably thousands of these franchises were sold by different franchisors. And I think the vast majority of them failed, and very quickly, because the concept of selling stuff on eBay still works. eBay's still out there, but the idea of having to rent a retail space, staff it, and have the space be large enough to accommodate all the stuff you're taking in, the numbers just didn't work. You had to generate such a large volume of business each month, it was very difficult to be profitable.
Wow. Yeah, I actually had a friend of mine who's actually in Toronto that owned one of those stores.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, he made it work, but he's a heck of a salesman. I mean, he really did. I mean, he said that was the hardest money he ever earned in his life.
And the people that I've talked to that were successful in that particular business were successful because they were really go-getters. It was not a question of opening a retail store and waiting for people to walk in. They went out and they found things like estate sales, freight consignments where there was some product that somebody wanted to unload and they resold it. So they really were using the retail location as a place of business and a springboard for other sales beyond just, you know, me bringing my kid's bicycle in there and want to sell it for $50 because their commission was 30%. So they got $15. That's a lot of work.
That's a lot of bicycles to cover the, you know, the monthly rent.
Well, how much space do you need to store all those
Yeah. Yeah, I say, well, hopefully you're not taking in bulldozers.
That's right.
Yeah. So when you're talking to a person interested in buying a franchisee, how do you tell them to check it out? I mean, to really figure out whether this thing is real and is it working? You know, what documents does the government provide to help you, and where should you look in there?
Well, under federal law, the government doesn't actually provide the document, but it requires that the franchisor provide the document, and it's called a franchise disclosure document. There are 23 separate items of information that are required to be discussed in there, everything from the background of the franchisor, the franchisor's officers and directors, the costs associated with starting the franchise, the number of units that are out there, legal requirements, and it's very detailed. So the starting point is actually read that document. And as surprising as it may sound, I can't tell you how many times I've had people come to me and say, I'm interested in buying this franchise. Here's the franchise disclosure document. We call it an FDD, and I want you to review it for me. And I say, fine. I say, have you reviewed it yet? No, that's what I'm paying you to do, Mike. So, you know, here you've got somebody that's going to invest typically high five or well into the six figures in a business, and they haven't taken the time to read it. And I always tell them, you know, get a pot of coffee. I mean, it's not the most interesting document, but get a pot of coffee and sit down with it one evening or Sunday morning or whatever and read it. And so that's a starting point. And make notes and take, you know, and develop questions on your own. Beyond that, there's a lot of due diligence that you can do. The starting point to me is every FDD has attached to it a list of all of the current franchisees and all the people who've left the system recently. And it has their contact information. And I would reach out to as many of those people as you possibly can and have a list of questions you want to ask them, ranging from how helpful was the franchisor in getting the business started? Did they get adequate training? Does the franchisor answer questions when they email the franchisor or call? Is there enough staff on the franchisor to service them? And ask them for financial information. Franchisees oftentimes are willing to share that. They'll send their business financials or pro forma to a prospect. And certainly you want to talk to anybody who has left the system for any reason, whether they've been terminated by the franchisor or they've sold the business or retired. And as that's a source of information that you want to have. So to me, that's a huge source of information. I always tell franchisees they should be creating a pro forma. It's like any other business that you start up. What am I going to spend the first month, the second month, the third month, and so on? And they should plan that out over a period of maybe 5 years and try to get a sense in a very conservative way on the revenue side and a very aggressive sense on the expense side. Is this thing going to work?
Yeah, I understand there. You know, one of my rules is it's going to take twice as long and cost twice as much as your very best estimate.
That's a good rule to go by. And if it still works,
yeah, you've got a fighting chance. It's not a guarantee. You get the guarantees from Midas Muffler, but in business, you take calculated risks, and that's one way you can help mitigate that.
And I think that as with any business, you have to look at what the competition is in the area. Where are you thinking of opening this business? Who are your competitors in the marketplace? Are you going to be in any situation the last one to the dance, unless you're the best looking person at the dance? I'm not. But you know, certainly if there's cupcakes, there was an article about cupcakes, I think in the Wall Street Journal the other day, and how it was questioning whether the cupcake market in the United States was saturated. And I'm not expressing an opinion on that. I'm not a big fan of cupcakes, so I'm probably not a fair judge. But there's certainly a lot of cupcake franchises out there. And the question would be, if you're the first one, well, that's great. You know, that's something unique. It's different. If you're the fifth one or the tenth one, the question is, how many are there in your neighborhood or the place you're going to have your business?
Another thing I wanted to be sure we covered, when we were talking about the franchise disclosure document, I understand there's a section in there on earnings claims. Now, that's an optional one, is it not?
It is. And sometimes earnings claims is or earnings claim is the terminology that was used for years. The franchise rule was updated by the Federal Trade Commission effective in 2007 and 8. And they've changed the terminology. It's now called a financial performance representation. But I still use the term earnings claim. And it, to me, that's an accurate description. And that's found in item 19. That's the vernacular in the industry of the franchise disclosure document. The FTC has rules about how one, if you're a franchisor, makes an earnings claim. And the idea is, you don't have to put that in there if you're a franchisor. You can choose not to give that information out. But if you do, it has to be done in a manner which is fair and an accurate representation. So just as an example, if you had 500 restaurants in the United States that were franchises and you picked the most profitable one because it happened to be located in Midtown Manhattan, and you only disclose that, that would probably be an inaccurate representation of what I could expect to make opening one of these in downtown Alpharetta. And so they would require, the FTC would require a fairer representation in some form, whether it's all the restaurants. Oftentimes we see all of the units that have been opened more than a certain period of time, because it's not necessarily fair to say include units that just got started 3 weeks ago or 3 months ago. But there are a lot of different ways to slice and dice it. And you can choose as a franchisor not to disclose that. Oftentimes, young systems choose not to disclose it because they just don't really have enough good data. That makes it a little harder if you're buying a franchise to get a sense of what you're getting into.
I believe about half of the franchises now have an item 19. I saw a statistic that, you know, alluded to that.
I think that's about right. And certainly they tend to be the larger franchisors. But a lot of smaller ones do give those disclosures. And if I'm working with someone and we can find a comfortable and accurate way to give that information, I think it's a selling point. Because why would I want to buy a business from you or work with you to start a business if I don't know how much I'm going to make? Isn't that the whole point of this? Why would you invest... Right. You know, some X hundred thousand.
I mean, if you want entertainment, go to Disney World.
That's right. Well, and I've told people, you know, look, if the point of starting this business is for you to make $600 mm-hmm. a week, maybe you'd be better off keeping your money and seeing if Home Depot is hiring, because I understand they're a good place to work and they have good benefits. You know, I'm not picking on Home Depot. I mean, legitimately, they are a good place to work. But why would you want to buy a business that doesn't mm-hmm. afford you more of an income than that?
Mm-hmm. What are the penalties for a company that you know, falsifies information in these documents from the FTC requires?
The Federal Trade Commission can fine the franchisor on a per violation basis, and I believe the current fine is $12,000. I could be mistaken about that, per violation. So that means every time that they talk to someone and misrepresent something or hand them the document that's inaccurate, in theory, that's a violation. In the real world, the Federal Trade Commission is not as aggressive, frankly, as I'd like them to be. They don't have the staff to typically enforce these rules, and oftentimes it's left to either the states that do regulate mm-hmm. this, those states that do regulate it, or you wind up essentially as a franchisor exposing yourself to a lawsuit. Not for violations of the Federal Trade Commission's franchise rule, because that doesn't give private individuals a right to sue, but for something else, breach of contract, fraud. Sometimes there's a state law that we can kind of run through. And why put yourself in that position? As a practical matter, if you get sued by several franchisees, unless you're a massive franchise system, it's going to dramatically adversely affect your franchise system, because those lawsuits are one of the things that have to be disclosed in the franchise disclosure document.
And that's a kiss of death.
Usually it is. And we've seen systems that were prospering that had a few disputes and perhaps lost one or two cases to franchisees. And, you know, the way the franchise agreements are written, it's difficult for a franchisor to lose one of these cases in many situations. So if you lose a case and a court or an arbitrator makes a finding of fraud, it's very hard to sell franchises going forward. And I always view franchise systems as being very dynamic. They're not static. So they're either growing or shrinking. And once they get to the point where they're shrinking, it's hard to put the brakes on and turn that around because you're not selling new units. And then what happens is probably you have some unhappy franchisees. So over time, they may close their doors, or when the franchise agreement expires, they may just choose to go do something else. They may retire or
get whatever, but you've lost the income stream from that unit.
That's right. And then when people see more and more failures, they're less and less likely to buy from you. And typically the way you see those things turned around is the system gets sold, somebody new comes in, they put some capital into it, they hire a new chief executive officer or a new team, and then they go out there and sell it as a whole new thing. You know, here we're fresh and new, and forget about those old guys. We're doing it differently.
Yeah, and the other thing that happens to you, and we were talking about this before that we went on the air, is the social media side of this thing today. If you have a bad franchise or you're not doing the job, it's hard. You can't hide. And even if you're doing a good job, there are sites out there that are just notorious for they're basically posting all kinds of screeds against franchisors, and they're almost extortions.
Yeah, and really they're two different sides of the same coin. But if you're not doing a good job for people, the word's going to get out there. And again, social media is a huge part of that now. But also the fact is that you have to give out the information on your current franchisees in this franchise disclosure document. Mm-hmm. So if I'm looking at buying a franchise from you, I can just call those people up, and certainly some of them are going to tell me how they feel. And some of them, if you listen carefully, they may not want to say anything bad about the system because they don't want to bring the brand down. But look, if I'm in a business and I'm a franchisee and I love it, you're going to hear the enthusiasm in my voice. And I'm going to say really good things about the system. Conversely, if I don't love it, but I don't want to bring the system down, I just may not say much, or as our mama
damnation by faint praise.
That's right. You know, as your mama taught you, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say.
Say
it. But if you don't have any, if you're not hearing good news, that's a bad sign.
Yeah.
And with social media,
there's
definitely a place where people can go out there and say things. And then the other side of the coin is, unfortunately, there are websites where even great systems can have bad things said about them, and sometimes I've had, I think, great clients that have great systems reach out to me and say, well, we've got a problem because there's this terrible thing being said about us on this bulletin board. And I told you a story about a client that contacted me. There was something horrible posted by supposedly a franchisee in Tampa, Florida. And I said to the client, so do you know who that franchisee is? And the response was, we don't have a franchise in Florida. So obviously a competitor or somebody, you know, for all I know, it's somebody that the franchisor's owner had a bad date with the night before, and she was out to get, or he was out to get even with her, you know. And but that is a concern with the internet.
Yeah. It's, you know, everything you read on the internet isn't true.
Yeah, that's certainly the case.
It's certainly not a French model, and this may not be the truth in terms of that franchise.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not knocking Wikipedia, but of course, it's just the people's dictionary or encyclopedia, and so there's some good stuff out there, and there's stuff that may or may not be accurate.
Exactly. So, you know, you have to be an informed consumer no matter what you do. So, you know, how do people find you? Do they come to you through brokers? Do they look you up online? How do they find you?
Well, certainly probably I get most of my clients through referrals, and it's from previous clients, existing clients, brokers. Franchise brokers are a big part of that, and franchise consultants who help people do the business side of their franchise system are a big source of business for me. Some people find me on the internet, fortunately, and like any other business owner, I'm always trying to figure out what I need to do to make sure that people can find me on the internet as opposed to my competitors. And the funny thing about what I do is it's a small enough marketplace, even in a big city like Atlanta. I know most of my competitors and actually have good relationships with the vast majority of them. They're good folks. So we're competing with people we like.
They're nice people, and I knew two or three of them likewise. And, I mean, they've all been just, you know, stand-up, really great people.
You know, it's kind of funny, but I liken the practice of franchise law to being a small-town lawyer. And, you know, here we are in Atlanta with, I don't know how many lawyers, 25,000 or some number, huge number. And I think when people get into disputes and situations in a big city, the lawyers perhaps tend to be a bit more aggressive because they may, you know, recognize they're not going to see that other guy or gal again. You know, I can bark a little louder. But if you practice law in a small town, and we were talking about before we got on air about Thomaston, it's a nice small town, a medium-sized town south of Atlanta. And I've been down there, and the lawyers treat each other, for the most part, with respect. And they're straightforward with each other because they know they're going to see that other guy or gal next week. And they're going to have to deal with the consequences of any bad behavior. In Atlanta, that's a little less so. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about the franchise bar is because we deal with each other so often, we really do behave well towards each other. And it's a very collegial group of people. We help each other all the time. I mean, it's really one of the fun things about doing what I do is that I can call anyone else in the franchise bar randomly or post something on a listserv that the American Bar Association has, and people respond, and they're really helpful.
So if someone wanted to go into the practice of law and they happen to have an inkling for business, is franchise law a good area to practice in?
I think so. I mean, I certainly really enjoy it, and it's, I think in the modern world, whether it's the practice of law or any business profession, specialization is important, and I enjoy being a specialist. I mean, I think it really, I get to focus on what I know. I deal with a group of people, for the most part, that I like, and so I would encourage that. The hard part is getting into it. And there just aren't as many slots or positions as one would think. I think the state of Georgia has 45 or 50 members of the franchise and distribution law section. That's in the whole state.
Wow, that's not very many.
No, we have lunches once a quarter, and there's usually a couple dozen people that show up. And almost all of those people are in the Atlanta market.
Yeah, I think we're about out of time. You know, it's been a fascinating subject, and if you're interested in buying a franchise, if you are a person who has a business who thinks they would like to expand it and not use your money to do it, and use franchise as opposed to try to escape the clutches of the FTC with a license, and want to find a very good attorney to advise you and help you through the process, how do they get in touch with you, Michael?
They can reach out and call me. My office number is 404-365-0005, and that actually is my direct line. Or they can reach me by the internet, and my email is msr@wjrlaw.com.
Well, thank you for being on, Michael. It's been a real pleasure, and I look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much. I really have enjoyed being here.